Hi, Nauti.
Good evening.
However, that exercise, I think, could be somewhat meaningless
unless there was something more behind it. And this is sort of what we need to really begin to delve into. A legal person, which is something that would derive from a legal right, is traditionally defined as one who can sue or be sued and own property. That is, an entity subject to legal rights and duties. And it can be human or non-human. Adult humans are legal persons, but so are corporations. So we're beginning to see that there are some nuances that we need to pay attention to. Now, going back to natural rights, or moral rights, if you will, moral persons are somewhat different. But again, they don't need to be human. For example, my dog, in the vernacular of the human rights or the animal rights movement, has a set of rights simply because he is the subject of a life. It means that he was born, he has a life consistent with the life of a dog, and at some point, he'll die. Now, it's true that there are laws protecting animals, but those are a fairly recent vintage, and what I'm really looking at, trying to explore, is what is the idea underlying moral rights, which are intrinsic to the entity. What is it, or is there something about an entity that, in the way it is perceived by us, allows it to make a demand on us in the form of a moral claim? Examples of the kinds of things that are discussed in the literature are sentience, the fact that it may be self-aware, that it has some sense of self, consciousness, intentionality, autonomy, language, carbon-based biology, nociception, which is the ability to sense pain or to feel pain, emotions, and as I mentioned, being the subject of a life, that is, it's born, it lives, and it dies. For any of you that have seen the movie Bicentennial Man with Robin Williams, that was the crux of his problem in that movie, is that until he died or had the ability to die, he wouldn't be viewed as a human. So when he became an organic human and died, he was given the status of human as a result of having had that experience. So these are all things that have been proposed as indicia. But the question is, do we need all of them? Do we need some of them? And what is the critical issue, or is there a critical issue? Because out of the list that I just gave you, we can think of instances where some or all, well not, I wouldn't say all, but any one of those things we could knock out and probably end up with an entity that has a moral claim. And then the real question that we're going to, I think, have to struggle with in the next 50 years, and this is a question I think Raoul will address in some more detail, is whether or not any of these qualities that we believe give rise to moral claims or to ultimately legal claims, whether or not they can be instantiated in a machine, in a non-biological substrate. If you take the position of the eliminative materialists like Paul Churchland, the answer is yes, because the human body is nothing other than a biological machine. It's a machine that is, if we understand it properly, replicable in a variety of substrates. Now, one other confounding problem, and I'll make this very short, is that we have historically not been very clear in some areas which I think are significant in making the kinds of distinctions that we will ultimately have to make, and that is we have not, humans as a group, been very careful in what we call human, person, or property. Historically, there's been a distinction between person and property manifested in a variety of ways, but those ways change over time. For example, the Greeks believed that slaves and women were not human because they didn't have souls. Later, it was developed that yes, they were human, but they were still property, and they could be treated as property. And it's really only within the last couple of hundred years that rights, both legal and moral, have been something that entities have intrinsically. And you see that in the animal rights movement, in the careful because these views are not universal. They are not held around the world by all people. Even though you would think if they are intrinsic moral rights, that they would be held by all people by definition. So, again, we have to be very careful. My own feeling is that the less property-like something is viewed, the more likely it is that at some point a degree of moral and ultimately legal consideration will be given. If we are treated or grown up with entities such as David in the movie AI, Artificial Intelligence, my suspicion is that we will anthropomorphize. We will give values to whatever that entity is, and then make a similar kind of moral calculus that we do with animals, because that is basically, I could argue, where animals are beginning now to get some traction in terms of moral rights. And it's because of our anthropomorphizing. But I think it's only by repeatedly examining and testing the questions that we're posing and discussing tonight that we'll arrive at a point where someday we might answer the question posed by today's topic rather than by saying no with a yes.
So as Quinn said, I am a professor in engineering college, and I guess this is the first time in some 15 years I'm giving a talk or talking to anybody without PowerPoint presentation. So if I keep looking back, don't be surprised. In my daytime, I work on a bunch of things related to making programs exhibit intelligent behavior. Okay, and to the extent I think at all about rights and robots, it's always more in the context of what rights do humans have, and what responsibilities do designers of robots have in terms of liability and so on. So it's quite interesting that we are now today talking about the opposite issue, which is do robots themselves have rights? Okay. So the first question that I kind of want to share with you is, what's my role here? It wasn't too obvious to me what I can tell you about whether or not robots should have rights. So then I remembered a very interesting NOVA program that I saw some years back. It was a NOVA program on who killed John F. Kennedy. I don't know how many of you have seen this. This is normally not the kind of fare that NOVA does. It was actually, what they did was they considered variety of conspiracy theories of who killed John F. Kennedy, and with beautiful background music so that you can almost see it happening, and then debunk it. Okay, so say that it's scientifically implausible for that particular explanation as to who killed John F. Kennedy. And then when the program ended, I remember this tagline, and the tagline was, science can never explain or answer who killed John F. Kennedy. But whatever is the theory or explanation somebody is providing should stand the test of scientific plausibility. And to some extent, I think my role here is sort of similar. I can't really, other than as a normal societal human being, I can't really give you any considered insight as to whether or not robots should have rights. I mean, I can just be on that side of the dais and I have my opinions just like you have. They're not particularly technically informed. But what I can do is consider the kinds of scenarios where we might think robots may have rights and tell you whether or not, given the current technological progress of AI, whether that sorts of futures, A, are feasible, and B, can we avoid them? Okay, so let me talk about the avoidance part. I'm not a lawyer, so I actually don't mind if more and more things don't have rights. I mean, presumably David would like to have more things having rights so that you can represent them too. So the question then is, if I know what are the conditions under which robots will start having rights, and to the extent it doesn't affect the endeavor of AI for them do not have those properties. I'm very happy to design robots without those properties. Okay. So that brings us to the first question, which is this idea of, is AI's goal really directly connected to making human equivalent robots? Okay. The one thing that I can tell you as somebody working in AI is that that's not actually the case. In most current work in AI, Android robots notwithstanding, essentially takes the position that the goal is to design programs that can show rational behavior, okay, and the behavior that when shown by humans you might consider intelligent. Now, speaking as just a societal human being, I don't think that we decide people, we don't necessarily seem to give rights to entities just because they have intelligence. More interestingly, we seem to give rights because, for example, they can feel happiness, they can feel pain, they have emotional status and so on. So that brings me to the question, is it possible to design robots which don't show emotion? Forget about whether they have or not, you know, whether they don't show any emotional state, they don't show pain, they don't have various other things. And in fact, 2 weeks back, I was in a technical, somewhat more technical AI gathering where I was asked to imagine a future for AI, the discipline, and I was there arguing that, in fact, we probably increasingly need to consider human-aware AI in the following sense. Even if you want to design robots that don't necessarily have to have any emotional state, if they need to coexist with us, you, me, and the rest of us, they need to at least fake emotions. Okay, there is a significant amount of work out there showing that, you know, a computer talks back at you with a funny voice saying, my God, you made this mistake for the 15th time, we'll get a hammer on its head. Whereas if it sort of fakes synthetic voice, we tend to take its advice more seriously. So to some extent, even if robots don't need emotions to show, to reach intelligent behavior, if they have to work with us, they need to have to deal with emotions because we have them. And we seem to, you know, it's the same exact thing said without the right emotions, we take it wrongly. And so there is a reason why even if I don't want to design robots which will require rights, I may be forced to do so because to be effective, these robots will have to work with us, and we essentially would like certain properties for the robots to have, for things that interact with us to have. So I guess my the point that I'm, the convoluted point I'm trying to make is that in a way I would have avoided this whole discussion if I believed that it's possible to actually develop robots that don't show properties that would make us think they need rights. Now notice that this is another thing again that's slightly out of my area, but all of us can talk about this, which is this whole discussion is we deciding whether robots have rights. Now if in fact, you know, if you believe in the science fiction view of AI, there may well be 50 years from now on the other veranda a separate robotic conference with robots attending deciding whether we need rights, and they will then decide whether we need rights. And what's interesting is that we are quite fickle. I mean, again, this is me, the human being, as against the AI expert talking. We are quite fickle in deciding who has rights, who don't have rights. You know, David talked about the fact that animals have rights. There are enough plants which actually can be seen as doing quite intelligent things, and yet we don't consider plants as having rights. And similarly, when we talk about pain, you know, there is all sorts of interesting issues. If we don't think somebody feels pain, then, for example, that's what matters. So, I mean, there's this, I think the other day I was watching some Cartoon Network cartoon about circumcision and how, for example, American Pediatric Association has decided in their infinite wisdom for a while that children don't quite feel pain. You know, they're anyway crying all the time, and so, you know, one more cut here and there won't make any difference. And so the question is, if the kids can talk, what would they say? And this is a Cartoon Network thing, and this little boy was going saying, "What? I just got this thing," you know. So the point again that I'm trying to make is we are deciding whether somebody has rights or not. And so that's where it comes to the point of what are the properties that we seem to consider as important for some entity to start having rights. I also wanted to say, as I said earlier, that it may not be easy to design robots that won't have those properties if they have to deal with us, because they have to at least fake emotion. And once they fake emotion, I think we will start saying they have rights too. Okay, so that's more or less where I will stop. And as I said, part of what I will try to do is give you a sense of where we are in whenever you have questions on whether certain types of futures for robotic design are close or far, I might be able to give you some idea. So I'll stop there and then let's open up for questions.
Thank you. When I think over the last 100 years, yes, I suppose rights have been granted to new groups, but in most of those cases, funds that they've been granted have been demanded, that there's been social movements that have risen up from the people who believe that they're disenfranchised and have demanded that the rights that others have be allocated to them as well. And I'm wondering if you can just reflect on that right now for a few minutes. Can we imagine social groups of robots demanding rights? And this is just something that we don't even know what those robots would be like, what those artificial intelligence would be like. We can begin to imagine what a scenario like that would be. I just wonder how much philosophy is going to have to do with it in the end, how much social movement is going to do.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective. In one of the earliest talks that I gave in this area, I invented a group which I called PETA, P-E-T-A, People for the Ethical Treatment of Androids. And point's obvious. It does. And I think if you look at this, slavery is a good example to look at, particularly in Western English and American tradition, that most of the pressure for change in that area in the late 1700s in England, early 1800s in England, came from a very select group of religious, social critics of the current system. And they became very, very powerful in their persuasiveness. And so the English history of slavery was much different than it was in the United States. And that was a bottom-up sort of development. And I think an analogy in the States you can see with the suffragette movement, the women's rights movement, that was. And it goes back, I think, to what Fort Rao is talking about, and that is, in order for a machine to interact with people, does it have to have certain human characteristics? Or does it have to be aware of human characteristics? Does it have to be programmed in a way which it takes into account that humans have feelings, and being called stupid jerks is not usually the best way to get them to do what you want them to do? So if you build that into a robot, it becomes sensitive to humans and modifies its behavior through learning algorithms in a way in which it can interact freely with human beings. Is there any difference between it and a human being? Is it functional, or does it have to have phenomenal consciousness or functional consciousness? Which of the two is really sufficient? If it's functional consciousness, then I think that you will get the possibility of certain people saying you can't treat this machine in that fashion because it has recognition of does act the same way we do. So I suspect it would come up in very much the same way, but the driver would be, as I said before, anthropomorphic characteristics that are either built into the robot by the designer, another kind of subset of issues. More likely, it would be through epigenetic learning, or learning in an iterative sort of way the robot actually engages in itself. Much like a child. A child doesn't know from day one how to interact with its peers or with adults. It learns over a period of time. And if robots are set up in this fashion to learn to interact with human beings, the question is, do you then end up with a functional human being?
So, to the extent, I mean, I'm not exactly going to answer your question, because to some extent, the earlier part of the future is likely to be more going to be about whether we think robots are showing enough intelligence that we must give them rights. In fact, there's a beautiful quote that I actually read in David's paper, you know, from Rodney Brooks, who basically said that, "I would think that my robots have started becoming intelligent when my grad students start feeling slightly guilty about shutting them off in the night." Okay, so the question is, again, ultimately we are going to be the first to start arguing for rights before robots will start arguing for their rights, because I think as a technical AI person, I think I can still control the way robots will behave, at least for the foreseeable future. Now, what's interesting in that level, again, is there's this dichotomy, which is the mainstream AI's goal is no longer connected to computers being seen as humans. In fact, the first, the very beginning of AI was the paper by Alan Turing, who is considered the father of AI, who developed this thing called a Turing test. Maybe probably several of you are familiar with it. And the idea there is, you would say that, in fact, he was trying to argue a slightly different question. When would you consider something other than humans to be intelligent? Okay, and he made this thing about, if you can have a free-ranging conversation with an entity behind a screen, and at the end of the thing you get to decide whether it's a human or a machine, then if you are 30% of the time the machine is able to fool you, then presumably the machine is actually intelligent. Now, what's interesting is a guy who was a millionaire called Loebner started a Loebner competition for a while, and it ran for a while. People would make chatterbots, and then people from, you know, street would be asked to come and talk to the chatterbots to decide whether they're talking to humans or chatterbots. One of the most interesting anecdotes from that competition to me is that to make a controlled study, they had to also have humans behind the screen once in a while, so that you can not really tell whether it's humans or machines. There was this one particular guy who, you know, it was not a general Turing test, it was a specialized one where you can, the chatterbot can say, this is my specialization, and you will then have to have conversation in that area. There was this one guy who was a Shakespearean scholar, and so you would have a conversation with him, and more than 30% of the people who talked to him decided he was a machine, because they decided that nobody real would be that crazy about Shakespeare, you know, at that level. So what does that tell me? Again, humanity and intelligence is, again, you know, in our eyes. And a related point, of course, is significant number of applications of AI technology that's going to come into our midst is going to be assistive technology. In fact, this is one of the things that was not realized, I guess, several years back. In fact, one of the big application areas now for AI is helping disabled, helping old people whose children and grandchildren are probably busy doing something else, and so they are being provided robotic help. Now, in those cases, if the robot basically does not show human empathy, then the assistive technology falls flat. It just doesn't work. You know, you're not going to take, you know, advice from entities which don't sound human. It's bad enough that they're fake, but, you know, if they don't at least sound human, you're not going to take them seriously. So we are going to be already technically busily trying to figure out what can we do to make these programs that can understand human emotional state. And so we are on that path for technical reasons. And at that point, once we go far enough, I can see normal people, not the robots, normal people saying, look, these programs sound like humans, so they might need rights. Okay, so that's something that's probably closer to the future. I don't know how we're going to deal with it. I'm just saying that it's not possible to make the robot ugly and with pointy head, etc. If you want to send the robot to Mars, that's fine. Okay, and in fact, but if you want the robot to work with you, you know, we just need it, not because I like humanity, but my programs have to get with humanity. The talk that I gave on the future of AI, which is called Human Aware AI, had a tagline saying, darn humans, can't live with them, can't live without them. And AI is an interesting position that way, because you need to fake emotions at least. And once you do that, you start towards the position where people will start saying maybe they need rights too. Yes.
There's a couple of questions that have come up, and one of them is not exactly on life, but it follows the thread that you're taking about looking at the point of view of the human dealing with the robot rather than from the point of view of the robot, whatever it may become. And I'm wondering, and I'm not sure it's how I feel, but when people are cruel to animals, there are laws preventing that, presumably for the protection of animals, but also I think for an ethical, comes from an ethical point of view, that that's not what people ought to do. And then law and ethics sometimes overlap, and so in that case, the laws for the protection of animals are also for the protection of human society and for maintaining standards of and from that point of view, then I'm wondering if you think about addressing the question again, at what point do we believe that humans ought not to behave that way for the non-living entities, and how that was figured out. And just one suggestion, and I'll leave off, is right now in environmental philosophy, environmental ethics, there are several ways of supporting the idea that we ought to behave for the environment in a certain way. Even though the thing is not living or just a creature, we're compelled ethically, in this case, to not do certain things to behave.
Yeah, I think the environmental area, I'll answer the question kind of backwards, I think. The environmental area raises some interesting questions, particularly about legal standing. The question of whether something has the right to go into court to assert a claim has been the subject of quite a bit of litigation. And there are courts drawing a blank right now, but there are some issues about whether trees have standing, whether scenic vistas have standing. So that is definitely an area that has some analogies. But to answer your initial point, Immanuel Kant's theory about animals was that we should not mistreat animals because it reflects badly on us as humans if we mistreat them. And so that indirect theory of animal rights was in contrast to René Descartes. Basically said, if I hit a dog over the head with a hammer, it's no different than hitting a clock. The person that owns the clock and the dog might have a claim against me because I destroyed their property. But the animal doesn't have any soul, doesn't have an essence that we view as being significant. And again, I have to remember, we're talking here, Kant, Descartes, and Jeremy Bentham, I mentioned before, but Bentham's view about animals is that they have rights because they suffer. And his view about animal rights in that sense is what really led to, in the late 19th century, particularly in England and centers are surrounding the life of time, the period of their life, and it's the development of enlightenment ideas. And what you find also happening during the enlightenment is a de-emphasis on society and rights coming from God, natural law, to rights being inherent in the individual, and a development of the beginnings, anyway, of liberal individualism, which is what the entire Western, particularly in the U.S., what the entire legal system is based upon, protecting the individual from predation by government. That's the theory behind it. So what you need to keep in mind is that we're in a long-standing tradition that sort of guides you in a particular way if you make certain beginning assumptions. And those beginning assumptions are, I think, what are critical, because if you assume that the robot has emotions, or acts emotionally, or has feelings, or suffers, or is conscious, then if you're consistent in your theoretical argument from the philosophy, it leads you in a particular way. If you start with the premise that it's property, that it's no different than my computer, or the computer that people have in front of them, and if I get really, really torqued one day and I throw it across the room, I know I'm not going to go to jail. But if I do that to my dog, it's a different question. So one is property, one is something else. It might be property, but it's got some other things attached to it. And to the extent that robots of the future look like the robots on the assembly line, no question. They aren't going to have civil rights for those kinds of robots. What we are concerned about, though, are the potential for robots developing near human attributes, whether they're programmed into them, whether they develop, or whether we simply give them. Some interesting work is being done by Sherry Turkle at MIT, where she takes these baby seals, or their robot seals, and puts them with elderly people in nursing homes. And people immediately create bonds with these dolls, with these robots. And so there's some real question about whether, as she expressed concern in some talks I've had with her, about whether it's ethical to give these people these robots, let them build these emotional ties, and then take the robots away. So there are all kinds of nuances to the issue, and we have to be very careful about how we phrase the questions, because I think those questions will, in some ways, dictate the answers.
Yeah, so the thing that I want to add, I guess, in this context is, again, David mentioned, and I guess to some extent you were talking to, that once some entity is seen to have feelings, is seen to have intelligence, we might start thinking that certain types of behavior against them should not be condoned. The problem, and this is a very well-known problem, is we are notoriously bad in judging whether other things are intelligent or not. I mean, one of the earliest programs in AI is a program called ELIZA, which Joe Weizenbaum wrote. And what he did was, it was basically a simple pattern analysis. It will take the English text that you type, look for certain phrases, and then canned answers. And it was meant to be a Freudian psychoanalyst, meant to imitate a Freudian psychoanalyst. And this was, you know, way back when you had really bad keyboards, etc., etc. And then, you know, Joe Weizenbaum meant it to be as like a plaything, etc. And then he suddenly found that the lab secretaries were pouring their hearts out to this this program, okay? And so Joe actually decided that he should stop this project because he felt there are ethical issues involved here, because, you know, I mean, what if you start recording all the stuff that, you know, somebody is throwing at you? Now, the point I'm saying is, obviously, lab secretaries are people like you and me, and maybe even smarter, and, you know, they couldn't tell whether something is should be considered to be, you know, intelligent or not. And maybe this is something about psychoanalysis, but, you know, the point remains that we are not very good at deciding it. Now, even though Joe Weizenbaum stopped doing this kind of work, now it's coming back into vogue because think about the following issue. If I'm making robots, what's the hardest thing that I would be stuck with? What are some of the hardest problems that I would have to deal with in getting robots to, you know, do interesting things? And let me give you an anecdote. So Magellan the Explorer went around the world 3 times. On one of his trips he died. Which trip did he die in? Okay. I hope there is nobody in the science museum who don't know the answer. But it's hard to design a robot which doesn't have a pattern-based answer to this. We don't have, none of us have preset knowledge in our head saying that if explorers go around the world 3 times and if they die, they must have died on the 3rd time. You know, we have a lot more deeper knowledge from which we make shallow inferences and come to this. The point is, getting robots to know what a 4 or 5 year old knows is the hard part. Okay, getting them to do inference is not, once they have the knowledge, using that knowledge is not as hard as putting that knowledge in. Now, how do human babies learn it? Evolution co-opted us. They look cute. Because they look cute, we spend hours and hours and hours and, you know, talking to them and helping them, you know. And so one idea is to use Tom Sawyer effect. So AI people are interested in making you guys help our robots. So there is projects, in fact, in MIT and various other places, you know, where you just put a cute face on a robot. You know, it looks like a robot with all sorts of nuts and bolts, but we are also very easy to be taken as to what is cute. As long as it has 2 eyes and, you know, has eyebrows going up and down, we think it's cute. And so, you know, there is this reason why, again, you wind up co-opting the human ability to spend hours and hours with things that they think are cute, things that they think are intelligent, to help do the work of AI. Now, this is not, I guess, the point, again, is there are good reasons to have to do this from technical point of view, because sitting down and writing all common sense knowledge into robots is not as easy. Okay, so that's the one thing. And the one other point that I just want to mention is many things we overestimate what is required to show intelligent behavior because we know one type of intelligent behavior. In fact, this issue of explanations. If I do something and I tell you an advice, if I give you an advice saying this is the right thing to do, the first question you'll ask me is why, okay? And I need to fake an explanation. Even if you have no sense of understanding what, if I'm a neuroscientist and I tell you that you need this particular type of operation, you're going to ask me why. And if I give you a technical information, you probably won't understand it. But if I say, you don't need to know, just do it, then you'll go to the next doctor, okay? The same thing happens with robotic advice givers. They can come up with the right advice, but if they cannot explain it, or if they cannot explain it in ways that we think are explanations, they are not going to be used. Okay? And oftentimes, actually, like the stock market, after the end of the stock market day, somebody comes up with a bogus explanation as to actually what happened. And if they knew this, how come they weren't becoming billionaires in the morning? We post fact to rationalize and give an explanation, but they are important to us, and to the extent they are important to us, they have to be important to the programs that have to deal with us.
Upgraded to newest technology.
things that that you read about in this area, particularly if you read somebody like Ray Kurzweil, his book, is that computers will, there's another concept I'll throw out, even though we certainly don't have time to get into it, and that's called singularity, which a lot of people, both in AI and science fiction, and in a variety of technical areas, talk about. Essentially, the singularity is where the technical growth curve becomes exponential. And at that point, the argument that Kurzweil makes and other people make is that computers will be self-evolving. There's another writer, Hugo de Garrett, he's at Utah State, has written about what he calls Artelect, as opposed to androids, but essentially the same thing. And at that point, then the entity becomes self-replicating, self-reinforcing, and the argument is that it will begin to demand a certain level of recognition that we won't even recognize as something that we can relate to. I think I used that word about three times in the same sentence. But yet, your point is well taken, that if those people are correct, and I believe that there are designers out there in the world, they may not be mainstream, but they are trying to design computers, robots, that have the capability to transcend where they are right now and to learn themselves, that those kinds of issues may not even be issues that we have an ability to control or to deal with. And we just may have to recognize it. The one thing that we, and I think Ralph touched on it, that it's incumbent on designers of computer programs and robots more than the term of, then you have to design an ethical machine. Maybe you need to design the machine to be ethical to humans, to recognize that these soft, which biological things that run around all over this earth have certain rights and should be protected against this mechanical, electronic, synthetic entity. So those are issues that need to be and are being addressed by some people.
Okay. I kind of felt that you guys were concentrating a lot on emotions for a while.
On
emotions, their emotions. And I want to know why would one of those have emotions if it can, basically, emotions that can be hurt and they can also lead to disaster. When we're making programs or when we're creating a computer, we kind of pass a little chip to the computer which they decide what operations to do and what kind of steps to take. When we can't control those, why do we want to create emotions so down the road they can create emotions on their own and not like certain behavior of a human being? Or, I mean, we're trying to make robots to make our life easier and have information and help complement, so it's not to create new species and create more problems that we already have on the planet, you know?
So let me just start by saying a slightly unrelated thing, and then I'll get back to it. I was listening to an interview with somebody on NPR who is an expert on artistic spectrum disorders. Artistic spectrum disorders are ones where they are completely intelligent, but they are basically emotion deaf. And she pointed out that since she's so much into it, whenever she talks to audience anywhere, she spends half of the time trying to figure out who is artistic, and trying to figure that out. Except when she talks in engineering college campuses, when she's trying to figure out who is not artistic. So the point of that is that if we can get by without having robots without emotions, engineers would be very happy to design them. My whole point was, in fact, I started by saying I'm happy to design robots which don't have emotions. I have to deal with people with emotions already, exactly like you. But the issue that I'm making is, if to the extent robots have to deal with us, Okay, I mean, I think the emotions, there's this colloquial meaning of emotions, which is, you know, this person has so much emotion means they're like crying and bawling, but that's not the only issue of emotions. Emotions of understanding the mental status of you, and depending on if you made this mistake, you know, the second time, sort of showing the right tone of voice to tell you that you're making a mistake. That ability is very important in my view, and in fact it's being shown, not because I like emotions, it's because humans are emotional, whether you like it or not, you know, whether you and I are emotional or not, humans in general seem to be emotional, and you need that, you know, that ability to handle that. So I completely understand that. That's why I said, if it's not needed, we don't have to design it, because we are the people designing these robots. But the slippery slope is, for them to be effective with us, they need to at least be able to understand our emotional state. And there are actual objective experiments that have been done on let's say, you know, like driving instructions, for example, what sort of voices will be at, you know, will, you know, if you put a certain type of voice in the driving instructions, people tend to listen to them more than certain other types of voices. And similarly, there's a lot of work that's going on in the human-computer interaction, where when to disturb somebody and to say that there is a mail for you. You know, I mean, all of you who have Windows machines know that right in the middle of important stuff, it says, you know, you have mail, you know, and in fact shows snippet of the mail too for everybody in the audience to know what it is that it's talking about. And you would like to control that such that, you know, the human secretaries know when to interrupt their bosses, right? Our computer secretaries should also know that. And to that extent, they need to understand our mental states and our emotions. And so I'm taking a very utilitarian view. I wouldn't do it if it's not needed. But my feeling is it would be needed just to get by.
There's, as Rao indicated, the early days of AI was to develop a rational computer, a rational robot. In robotics, there's a concept that's been known since the early 70s called the uncanny valley. And what that refers to is if a robot or an android begins to look too close to a human, that people are repulsed by it. It creeps them out. I'm developing an argument that there's a similar uncanny valley with respect to emotions, that if you think of Mr. Spock from Star Trek, pure rationality, there was something where people had to stay a back from it that kind of creeped them out. And I think the same is true with respect to emotions, that there is an uncanny valley that has to be recognized, that if something doesn't have enough emotion, if it doesn't act in a proper, quote, proper way that we expect of another human being, it's a sociopath, and you don't want to be too close to them. So I think emotion is absolutely critical in terms of human-machine interactions at these much more sophisticated levels. Certainly not at a tool level. But.
So I actually just have one additional point on that, which is, so I mostly talked about why emotion might be needed for computer programs just to deal with humans. There is untested theories out there which basically point out that humans, at any rate, the difference in the word sociopath triggered this. And one difference between sociopaths and normal people is the emotional deafness. And to some extent, for example, if they're making the same mistake for the thousandth time, their brain waves don't seem to have any premonition of something big, bad being done. Whereas normal people like you and me, apparently, the thousandth time when you're about to make a huge big mistake that you're repeated in the past, you would have this premonitionary impulses. Now, what these emotions wind up doing in a sort of a purely decision theoretic terms is that the space of decisions is huge. And in trying to decide, for a robot to decide what to do next, if it actually looks at all possible decisions, you know, the amount of time it has to think versus act is not enough. So you would need to make sometimes, there should be biases to push you towards certain parts of the Bayesian space, and there is theories out there which say that you may need, you know, the status of emotions, and why we have emotions is partly because of that. To that extent, maybe we will have to use that for robots too, but I don't know that.
There's some work being done now. The one that comes to mind immediately is Josh Green. I think he's at Harvard. I don't recall. But Josh's work is basically that human beings make decisions in the limbic system and the emotional system, and then the rational system kind of acts as an editor. And so that you make a decision based on your emotion, and then your rationality says, I'm going to act on that or not act on that. which is entirely contrary to 250 years, certainly, of the legal system, which believes that people act rationally and make rational decisions because they have free will. That might be kind of an overstatement, but it's an area that there's a lot of work being currently done.
Do you have one more point? Okay, just one small point. I mean, we talk too much in future. I want to talk about a project I'm involved in right now, just which I would not have been involved in like a year or two back. This is a project involving humans and robots trying to take part in rescue scenarios. And one aspect of it, there's lots of stuff that goes on. One aspect of it is robots to be aware of effect in the human voice. So there are experiments showing that, you know, if you have time-dependent goals, and as the time is ticking, and it's about to be done, the humans start raising their voice and become squeaky, saying, do this! And then if the robot just says, this is just the same do this as the previous do this, you know, it doesn't go well at all. And so, in fact, we had to, but the point is, it's not that hard to fake understanding. All you need to do is to realize that it is high-pitched, even by this guy's, you know, standards, it's very high-pitched voice. And then, you know, use that information to say the same do this goal now has much higher importance than the previous do this goal, okay? And that just actually makes a difference in the number of things you can rescue. So that's an interesting connection.